From PRI and WNYC, this is the podcast of Studio 360, public radio's premier program about creativity, pop culture, and the arts, hosted by Kurt Anderson. This podcast is a segment of the hour-long show, which can be heard weekly on public radio stations across America. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Every human who's ever lived, regardless of where or when, has appreciated the importance of symmetry.
Now, a last supper I commission from you, and a last supper I want. With 12 disciples and one Christ.
One?
Yes, one. Now, will you please tell me what in God's name possessed you to paint this with three Christs in it?
It works, mate.
Works?
Yeah. It looks great. The fat one balances the two skinny ones.
That's Monty Python, of course. When Michelangelo painted The Last Supper, he was guided by a force even more powerful than the Pope, symmetry. Symmetry is so pervasive, it touches on everything from quantum physics to zoology to a good haircut. For thousands of years, most human beings have plodded through their lives without giving symmetry much conscious thought at all. We've built houses and planned cities according to its rules. We've hung picture frames just so while our kids pounded out symmetries on the piano. But at the root of each of these, in fact, in the very fabric of the universe, lies a concept that nobody ever properly understood for most of human history. Not until two young guys came along in the 19th century and changed everything. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Joining me in the studio today is someone who's just published the book on symmetry. Mario Livio is senior astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. That's the headquarters of the one and only Hubble Telescope. In 2002, he wrote a prize-winning book on the miracles of the golden ratio, a concept lots of people first read about in the Da Vinci Code. Livio's new book is The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved, How Mathematical Genius Discovered the Language of Symmetry. Mario Livio, welcome to Studio 360.
My pleasure to be here.
Now, most of us, when we think about symmetry, which we don't very much, think of it as a kind of mirroring, that half of my face essentially mirrors the other half. But as you explain in the book, there are, in fact, four kinds of symmetry.
At least four when we speak in two dimensions. There are even more of them when you speak in more dimensions or in physics.
Well, let's stick to two dimensions.
Right. So, you know, there are the symmetries that you will observe in any, for example, wallpaper design. You know, when you have something that repeats itself, that's also a kind of symmetry, only it's not symmetry under reflection, which is the one you talked about that our face has. We call it symmetry under translation, which means you shift a certain direction, a certain distance, you see precisely the same thing. Then there are symmetries under rotation. You know, you take a snowflake and you rotate it by 60 degrees, it stays the same because it has, you know, six identical rays.
Or a flower or
right, or many such other things that, you know, or a circle for that matter, you can rotate by any number of degrees and it stays the same. And then there is something called glide reflection, which is the symmetry you get from a left-right walk.
So footprints in the
right.
On the sand would
that's
be that.
Right. That's right.
And obviously, for all of human history, presumably, human beings have looked at those things and felt and seen and known their symmetry, whether they could describe it mathematically or not. At the heart of your book, your new book, is a really kind of moving story about the two young mathematicians who stumbled on to the modern explanation of symmetry 200 years ago. Tell me about them.
Yes. So these two young mathematicians were a Norwegian young person by the name of Niels Henrik Abel. A very sad story. His entire life, poor as a church mouse, dies at 26 of tuberculosis. But he manages to prove that a certain equation cannot be solved by the usual methods.
And that's an equation that people had been trying to solve for
hundreds of years before that.
And he said, don't worry, it can't be solved.
That's right. I mean, he said, you know, you shouldn't bother because it's doomed from the beginning. And then there is this young French mathematician by the name of Évariste Galois. He is probably the most romantic of all scientists, maybe of all time. I mean, he dies at 20 in a duel. But he not only proves again that that equation couldn't be solved, but in the process of doing that, he actually invents the language of all the symmetries of the world.
That sounds like one of those classic inspired eureka moments that aren't supposed to exist that often.
I agree. I mean, usually when you look in science, I mean, even at some of the greatest discoveries, you discover that it was in the air at the time. And had the person not done it, somebody else would have had, you know, within a couple of years or so. In Galois' case, and indeed in Einstein's general relativity case, I mean, it's, you know, it's when somebody does something that wasn't in the air at all. Had he not done that, it probably would have taken many years for other people to have come up with that.
He was also, even in his genius adolescence, a kind of troublemaker of all kinds, right?
Oh, yes. You know, he lived in, you know, post-French Revolution time. So he was in prison twice. He was thrown out of school. You know, in his mind, the revolutionary ideas and mathematics were almost the same thing. I mean, when you look at his scribblings, you will see one line, you know, talking about, you know, liberty or death, you know, and so on. And then the next line is a line of mathematics. When he talks about indivisibility, you're not even sure if he's talking about mathematics or his Republican ideas.
Meaning Republican ideas, I want to add, in the old 18th and 19th century sense. Now, you said that Galois invented the language of symmetry, but certainly long before that, people were looking at daisies and designing towns and cities and were aware of all the symmetries that exist.
Right. But when you in mathematics, you want certain ways to describe this. I mean, perhaps the easiest way to talk about this is, you know, suppose you want to talk about the financial world. The language of the financial world is simple arithmetic, numbers. You know, you open pages of the Wall Street Journal, all tables of numbers. Mathematicians needed a similar language, so to speak, to describe symmetries and all their properties. And that language, which is called group theory, by the way, was invented by this Évariste Galois.
As I try to understand this new language that Galois invented, I still feel as if I'm skirting around. Is there an analogy that a simple-minded person like me can get to understand the nature of that language?
Yeah. What is at the heart of that language is this concept of a group. And a group is really something that has members and it has certain rules. And like, you know, like an exclusive club, they need to obey some rules. Take, for example, the integer numbers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and minus 3, minus 4, minus 5, and so on. And the simple operation of addition. Those form a group. The most important property of that is when you add two integer numbers, you get yet another integer number. You know, 2 plus 3 equals 5 and so on. And symmetries have this same type of thing. If you have a certain system that is symmetric, namely it doesn't change under some operation, and you perform this operation twice, then it still does not change. So in that sense, you know, symmetries are like these ordinary numbers that I talked about. And that was the thing that Galois recognized.
Does symmetry mean anything with a pattern, or is it more closely defined than that?
Well, symmetry really is immunity to a possible change. This is what symmetry
immunity.
Is. Yes, immunity. Yes, it doesn't change. You know, take the phrase, Madam, I'm Adam.
Palindrome.
It's a palindrome. Yeah. If you read it back to front, then it reads precisely the same. This means that this sentence is symmetric under the operation of back to front reading. So this is the meaning of symmetry, really, when you do a certain operation and things don't change.
Let's listen, if you wouldn't mind, to a clip from the television show Monk.
Okay, here you go. Four shirts, okay? Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Thank you, Mrs. Ling. Thank you.
What's
What's this?
Oh, that's nothing. Okay, bye-bye now. Bye-bye.
Let's go.
This isn't my button.
Your button fell off, but I found a new one. Identical. No difference.
Looks the same to me.
The button matches, but the stitching is all different. See, on the other ones, the thread is crisscrossed, but here, look. It's parallel.
That's how I sew them. Parallel. That's my style.
But it doesn't match. I have to live in this town.
That's Tony Shalhoub as Monk. Do we know why people like that character with obsessive-compulsive disorder are so obsessed with symmetries?
I don't think we have a full understanding of OCD, of obsessive-compulsive disorder, but we do know more about this than we used to know. People have now identified parts in the brain that are responsible for this. We are all at some level obsessed with symmetries. You know, if I wear my glasses, you know, completely tilted, you will have a hard time sitting and having a decent conversation with me. It would be very bothersome to you.
If you wore a monocle, I'd think you were a freak.
Yeah, so we are all bothered to this to some extent. In people with OCD, what happens is that apparently their process of relief does not happen. I mean, you know, we get relief after a while of looking at this, and they just get caught into this cycle, which they cannot get out of. But the general feeling of, you know, wanting to see things symmetric is inherent in all of us.
My guest today is Mario Livio, the astronomer and author of The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved. Coming up, the story of a famous Dutch artist who rolled up his sleeves and took on infinity. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we're looking at the ubiquitous power of symmetry. If math class wasn't really your bag in school, and I dropped out of math after 10th grade, you are not alone. All those formulas, what was the point? Well, a Dutch graphic artist born in 1898 felt exactly the same way. M.C. Escher failed his own high school exams. He briefly considered becoming an architect, but then bumbled around the world traveling. That is, until he discovered a better way to express himself. Sarah Lilly has the story.
Lately, I've been seeing tiles everywhere. Not just in my bathroom, not just in Scrabble games or accidental glimpses into restaurant kitchens. I've been seeing tiles in my dreams. And it's all because of a book I bought on M.C. Escher. Escher is the late Dutch graphic artist who's best known for creating images of impossible architecture, like hallways with multiple staircases that go sideways and ceilings that become floors. But he also had a passion for something he called regular division of the plane. It's basically like filling a blank space with repeating and interlocking tiles. But in Escher's hands, it became a lot more exciting. And it all started with a random visit to a very special place.
He made his first trip to the Alhambra in 1922, right after he finished his work at the Harlem School of Decorative Arts and Architecture.
Doris Schottschneider is a mathematician and author of the book M.C. Escher, Visions of Symmetry. She remembers reading Escher's personal notes on his visit to the Alhambra in Spain. The Alhambra is a huge and gorgeous Islamic palace, which was completed in the 14th century. Most visitors are struck by its architectural magnificence, its arches and courtyards. But Escher was drawn to its surfaces, its walls and ceilings spilling over with interlocking motifs and braided mosaics. When Escher saw these, he freaked out.
I think he was just overwhelmed, awestruck by the rich designs, the majolica tilings, the plaster incised designs, and so on. And I think he'd always had a great interest in order and repetition, and this kind of, I think, brought it to his attention with great force.
Escher was fascinated by the symmetrical repetition in the walls of mosaic tiles, but he wanted to take it further than the Islamic tradition would allow. He wanted to see figures in the designs. He pictured frogs interlocking with birds, or a line of black fish dovetailing perfectly with a line of white donkeys in a tapestry of bodies. The challenge was having these more complex shapes fit together in precise repetitions, and there could be no blank space in between, making it that much more difficult. He later wrote about his fascination.
If it counts as art, why has no artist, as far as I have been able to discover, ever occupied himself deeply with it? Why am I the only one captivated by it?
Without knowing it, Escher, who had actually failed in high school, slowly became a consummate mathematician of symmetries. And if that weren't enough, in the late 1930s, he read a professional journal on, get this, crystallography.
Crystallography is a multidisciplinary subject which studies really the interior, the molecular structure of crystals. And Escher really, really pored over that.
Crystals, it turns out, are like three-dimensional halls of mirrors with complex structures locked in endless repetition. They practically define symmetry, which for Escher was unbelievably handy.
You say, well, how many different kinds of symmetry groups can there be? I mean, you'd probably think there's an infinite number. But it turns out that there's only 17 different kinds, that there were only really 17 different collections of these that could send a tiling onto itself. Then he knew what he had to look for. He was really asking, okay, how can I describe the outlines of tiles so that they fit together like a jigsaw puzzle, but fit into one of these 17 categories?
Armed with the laws described by the scientists, Escher figured out how gracefully to wedge a black lizard's head perfectly into the crook of a white lizard's knee, and vice versa, to infinity. Look at a particular design of his, and your eye hopscotches from body to body. Your perspective bounces back and forth as foreground turns into background and then back again.
They are so clever and so surprising. You know, when you hear people at an exhibit and just kind of be a fly on the wall, you hear awesome and things like that.
Escher created 137 of these symmetrical designs. He had a dreamlike way of describing how he learned to make them.
A long time ago, I chanced upon this domain in one of my wanderings. I saw a high wall. I climbed over with some difficulty. On the other side, I landed in a wilderness and had to cut my way through with a great effort until I came to an open gate, the open gate of mathematics.
He said, the crystallographers are only interested in how the gate gets opened and not in the garden that lies beyond. And by that he meant they're only interested in classifying. And once they figured out how to classify things, then they sort of lose interest. He wanted to create.
Though he felt apart from the scientists and mathematicians, he was also an outsider to the world of artists.
He never founded a school. He was never part of any school. He was never part of any movement. He always felt quite isolated. The art world is a funny world, I think, in the sense that there is a great deal of anxiety and almost disdain towards things scientific and especially mathematical. And the idea is that somehow if you do things using some kind of a mathematical basis, that you lose freedom or creativity or whatever. And I strongly disagree with that. In fact, if you learn what the geometric rules are in this game of making periodic designs, then you know your restraints, your constraints, and then you're free.
Escher's incredible designs, which have been tacked to the walls of countless dorm rooms, were really his attempt to reconcile his love of order with his need to create. In his 60s, he gave a lecture to a packed hall of crystallographers in Cambridge.
The attention you have so kindly given my fantasies proves, I hope, that science and art sometimes can touch one another, like two pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, which is our human life.
For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lilly.
To learn more about Escher and see some of his periodic designs, you can visit our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the author and astronomer Mario Livio. His recent book is called The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved, How Mathematical Genius Discovered the Language of Symmetry. Mario, do you like Escher's works?
Not only like, I'm, you know, really enthused by Escher's work. Escher is absolutely phenomenal. I don't think there is anybody who doesn't actually like Escher's work. I mean, even if you have to be impressed at the very least. I mean, some of his things are so fantastic that, you know, they just boggle your mind.
Did you discover them as I did as an adolescent?
Yes. This was the first time that I saw them, and I remember they blew me away. I mean, at the time I was looking at all kinds of art, actually. I mean, you may remember this sort of kinetic art movement, you know, things like Vasarely and painters like this who also, you know, played with some symmetric designs, you know, and so on. But then, you know, you see Escher, and I mean, it really blows everything away.
Now, he was an outsider and not certainly considered part of the mainstream canon of art during his lifetime and his work. And I think a lot of that is simply because his work was so unlike the main currents of art during the 20th century. But I suppose there was, as that speaker in the piece said, something of the stereotypical artist's anti-rationality, anti-scientific view in the bias against him, or do you think that's so?
I think there may have been some of that. I mean, you know, especially 20th century is known for, you know, things like minimal art, you know, and conceptual art. And, you know, when you have streams like that, to suddenly have somebody who does something so meticulously, you know, and where the details are really so important, sort of goes against, you know, what people think about at the time. But I don't think that there is anybody who, you know, is not impressed with his art. And if you look at science books, you know, it is almost hard to find a science book that when they want to actually put something visual in it, that they would not include some of Escher's work.
Well, architecture, of all of the arts, does seem like a place that is all about symmetry more than the other visual arts, certainly, as much as music, and more obviously so.
There is a lot of that. Of course, you know, you look at most churches and most buildings, really, you know, and so on, and they are symmetric. Of course, you know, there are more modern streams that you will see where people actually do things not in a symmetric fashion. Some of the buildings, as a result of that, I mean, they are artistically very attractive or very interesting, but not always that functional. I mean, you know, you'll have these odd-shaped rooms, you know, and things like that and so on. So sometimes you do pay a price for, you know, this originality.
Well, and that originality of form and the fact sometimes that the buildings really are of these extravagant shapes. I think of some of Frank Gehry's buildings. Those buildings are designable only because of the power of computer design. They couldn't have been done 25 years ago.
Largely. Even though, I mean, you of course, you know, see buildings, for example, of Gaudi, you know, this great architect that, you know, every building looks like a sculpture. You know, it doesn't even look like a building. Now, of course, it takes very, very long to do those things, and this is why La Sagrada Familia, you know,
they're still working on it in Barcelona.
Yeah, that's right. So that's still not finished.
So the sort of perverse modern impulse to be asymmetrical is running against the tide, the overwhelming and irresistible tide of symmetry.
Yeah, it's running against, you know, what our minds are sort of trained to expect in some sense.
The astronomer Mario Livio is with me today in Studio 360. Like some of the modern architects we were talking about, some modern composers have sacrificed beauty for the sake of innovation occasionally. But one contemporary composer who makes music listeners actually like is Steve Reich. Maybe because a lot of his music adheres to more conventional notions of beauty, that is, of symmetry. Trent Wolbe talked to Steve Reich about the ways that composers and musicians use various kinds of symmetry to evoke various feelings in listeners.
Steve Reich is one of the most forward-thinking composers working today. But his most profound encounter with symmetry in composition dates back to the 18th century.
The C major prelude to Book One of the Well-Tempered Clavier by Johann Sebastian Bach, the symmetry of it is staggering, and everybody who is interested in symmetry in music, or I must admit, people who want to point out precursors of what has become known as minimal music, will generally pick out this prelude, the C major prelude of Book One of the Well-Tempered Clavier, as a forerunner of that because of the extreme symmetry of the rhythmic construction of the prelude. Every bar is in continuous 16th notes. It's written in 4/4. And if you were to break it down into the left hand, right hand, you have left, left, right, 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 left, left, right, 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 left, left, right, 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 right,
right, right, right, right, right, right, right, right, right, right, left, left, right, 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 left, left, right, 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 left, left, right, 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 right.
Completely unchanging throughout the prelude except for the very, very ending. Now, is it just repetition? No. It's what's called in music sequences. The rhythm stays the same, but the notes change. And basically he goes through beautiful series of harmonies in C major, beginning and ending in that key. The utter simplicity of it, the utter symmetry of it, may be a way of saying, I'm going to build something for you, and it's going to get fairly elaborate, and I'm going to really start simply. And I'm going to start in the most basic key, and I want you to just follow this.
Reich also looked at Balinese compositions and found unique types of symmetry distinct from the harmonic kind found in the European tradition.
There's a kind of rhythmic complexity and rhythmic counterpoint that far surpasses anything in the West. I studied Balinese gamelan Samar Pagulian, which is a very antique gamelan, which is a fairly large ensemble of metallophones, bars of metal suspended over resonators, maybe 20 or more people plus drums. And again, there's a lot of symmetry in the individual parts. What's interesting there in Balinese music, you'll have people playing, 16th notes, we might say. Other people playing ding, 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 ding. Eighth notes. Other people playing half notes. Other people. Then you've got some guy sitting there with some huge gong, and he plays once every 64 beats, he lets it go. And, that marks off the entire larger cycle. What does this come down when you're listening? When you're listening, you feel like you're hearing a very slow moving train and a kind of moderately moving train and a really fast, express train moving along at the same time. All those parts are unto themselves symmetrically. You have a great deal of repetition and they will have interlocking parts where the rests are filled in by the beats of the other part. It creates new rhythmic, melodic interest because there is no harmony in our sense of the word. You're basically staying in the same key or mode for a long time.
Symmetry in Balinese gamelan is a frantic and complex rush. But one of the oldest examples in the European tradition is a little simpler. It's called a canon or a round. Something like row, row, row your boat.
The first one we know about comes from a tune that's called Summer is a coming in Ludus in Cuckoo. Summer is a coming in, Summer is a coming in, Ludus in a knowing man, Summer is a coming in, Summer is a coming in. That's about probably 13th century. Then you've got, Bach writing canons that sound like Bach. Then you've got Bartok writing canons that sound like Bartok. In 2004, I completed a piece called You Are Variations. Second movement is a canon, another canon, which is going to be turned into a round just like row, row, row your boat. Now, something happens after that, which is also an aspect of symmetry, of changing gears, if you like, and then having another symmetrical relationship. And that's what's called in music augmentation. In simple English, it means the notes get longer. It's like as if you saw a film at regular speed and then you saw it slightly in slow motion. Dee-dum becomes dee-dum. Someone says, well, you know, what does a canon sound like? The answer is, I have no idea. What's the moral of the story? The moral of the story is that it's like an open, empty vessel. It says, here is a sound followed by itself in perfect symmetry. I don't know what that sound is. You got a glass. What are you going to put in the glass? Well, I don't know, bourbon, Coca-Cola, glass of water, seltzer? I mean, I have no idea. The glass will hold them. It's a vessel. But it's an empty vessel. It will always assume that shape, and the content is completely up to you.
For Studio 360, I'm Trent Woolby.
Steve Reich's latest record is We Are Variations. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the astrophysicist and astronomer and author Mario Livio, and we are talking about the wide-ranging wonders of symmetry in our existence. Mario, do you find Bach's music as compelling as you do M.C. Escher's art?
Absolutely. And not just Bach, I should add, but Bach definitely. I mean, Bach's music is so full of symmetries. And, you know, he was also playing with numbers. I mean, he liked numbers. His name is, encrypted in some of his, pieces and so on. And even the structure of the piece, you know, you take something like Musical Offering, you know, it has, you know, a richer car and then a five canons, then a trio sonata, then again five canons and again a richer car. So even the structure itself is kind of mirror symmetric, if you like.
And both on the little phrase level and then on this larger macro
right,
level.
Right, of the structure level. Right.
No, I often think of that like being an analog to buildings and their various symmetries and then the city grid. And that's the way that Bach works on those kinds of multiple layers of interlocked symmetries.
That's right. And you know, you can see all this type of symmetries, you know, like wallpaper, you know, where the same design element, if you like, but in this case, it's a theme, you know, repeats itself, you know, at intervals. And sometimes, you know, in order not to make this boring, it doesn't repeat itself exactly. You know, it repeats maybe the rhythm, but not precise notes. Sometimes maybe it repeats the notes, but something else, you know, happens that changes it a little bit and so on. Sometimes it first comes down and then it goes up like a reflection symmetry, you know, and so on.
Do you think that the music and the repetition in music like Steve Reich's or Philip Glass's affects our mental state differently than a Bach fugue does with its intertwining parts? Does it make for a different kind of mental focus?
I have a feeling it's roughly the same thing, but in the same way as we've seen in the visual arts, you know, a certain search for simplicity, you know, and a reductionism, you know, going into what the most basic elements. We've seen some of those things also in music, you know, and so on. But at the end, you know, they all play with all these rhythms and things. And music really does that more than any other medium because we have our own rhythms, you know, our heartbeat and, you know, the way we breathe, you know, and so on. And those rhythms sort of combine with our bodily rhythms, so to speak.
And pop music certainly seems very clearly symmetrical with the verse, the chorus, the hook, the verse, the chorus, and the hook, on and on. Doesn't all music exhibit symmetrical patterns of one sort or another?
It does. I believe that almost all music exhibits some symmetrical pattern. And there is also, you know, there have been researchers done on what we find attractive to the ear. And there is this notion called 1/F noise, you know, which there is a battle between making things very predictable and making things completely unpredictable. And what we, it turns out that what we like in all forms of music is something that's somewhere in between. You know, that's not entirely predictable, but also not entirely chaotic. I should add that personally, I find that I think as one grows older, you want it more and more predictable. That's my feeling.
The astrophysicist Mario Livio is my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson. Still to come in Studio 360, symmetry and sex. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is made possible in part by Nonesuch Records, presenting the newly recorded CD, Our New Orleans, a benefit album, featuring Irma Thomas, Randy Newman, Alan Toussaint's Yes We Can, and many others.
I'm too sexy for my love, too sexy for my love, love's going to leave me.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I've been talking with the scientist and author Mario Livio about the overarching power of symmetry everywhere we look and listen. But come on, does symmetry actually make us sexy too?
My shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
Joining Mario Livio and me now in the studio to talk about this is Kelly Kwan. For nearly two decades, Kwan has worked in the beauty industry as a makeup artist. Her work has appeared in Vogue, Glamour, InStyle, and other magazines, and in 1999, she founded the online fashion magazine Zuzum.com. Kwan has spent countless hours evaluating and prettifying the faces of the people whom we stare at the most. Kelly Kwan, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you have obviously worked with dozens, scores, hundreds of models, professionally beautiful people. Is symmetry key to what makes all those people beautiful to us?
I think generally, yes. There's, you know, the notable famous stars that we recognize, people like Natalie Portman, people like Charlize Theron, Christy Turlington, who are very, very symmetrical. I think there was a study done on Amber Valletta some years ago that she was the most symmetrical woman on the planet. And she was also
supermodel,
the most desirable.
I guess we call her, don't we?
Supermodel. You know, we see her everywhere. She was the face of Elizabeth Arden, I believe. She had the most symmetrical face. And for some reason, everyone adored her. She was completely, if you cleaved her face in half and mirrored it, that would be her. And that's highly unusual for someone to be so perfect.
Most of us are just approximately symmetrical.
Exactly. However, I'm also really drawn to the people who are not, who actually have opposing features in a way. And it somehow falls together beautifully. Angelina Jolie is a perfect example. Her features are so huge. They don't really seem to fit. And yet when you put it all together, she's gorgeous.
Well, it reminds me, Mario, of what you were saying before the break about we want symmetry, but not 100%. Is it true, as the scientist here in the room, that we are, you think, biologically wired to, you know, in an evolutionary way, in a mating way, to desire symmetry?
Well, you know, for animals, there are many studies which show that, you know, they choose mates based on symmetry. Now, some studies have been done on what do we find attractive. And they have found that we, by and large, and this goes across cultures and across ages and so on, we are attracted to more symmetric people. They even found that there was a correlation between symmetry and the amount of sexual pleasure that women get from symmetric males.
Really? And symmetry not just in facial features, but what, your arms being identical and all?
Yeah, they measure things that are related to both the face and the body. So the arms, the legs, you know, so they design this index of symmetry that is based on many measurements.
And is that because the beast within us all sees symmetry as an indicator of health and we want our genes to go with that healthy creature?
Oh, there is no question about that. And, you know, it comes from very clear roots. I mean, it's always easier to speak about animals. So, I mean, one I like to mention because it's always mentioned is the peacock and the peahen, yes? She wants a mate with strong genes and so on, but how can she tell? Well, it's enough to take one look at its tail. If its tail is completely symmetric, it means that this particular male has conquered its parasite, so it has strong genes. And that has been embedded in our brains as well. And so, you know, we are definitely looking for the symmetric.
Kelly, you talked about the few obviously spectacularly perfectly symmetrical people like Charlize Theron. Mm. But then there's somebody like Tom Cruise, who is in a certain way, for all of his, you know, highly marketable attractiveness, weirdly asymmetrical. You know, he's got this smile pushed to the side of his mouth and a tooth kind of in the center of it. How does he get away with being kind of, you know, being messed up and asymmetrical?
Well, that's interesting because I actually was thinking about this, his form of expression. Not only, I mean, his features per se are not perfect. And they run askew whenever he's in motion, when his face is in motion, either he's smiling or laughing or in action. But all of those things contribute to his attractiveness, if you will. I noticed one interesting thing that actually Katie Holmes and Tom Cruise both have mouths that slope downward when they smile, broadly. Both of them. If you look at images of them, they both go down on the left and up on the right. And I just thought that was rather odd.
Maybe, and it could speak
to... It's like they mirrored to themselves, exactly.
Yes, exactly. Symmetry between them, which the Greeks called narcissism.
Okay, well, there you go.
But then there are interestingly, spectacularly quirky, asymmetrical celebrities like David Bowie's eyes being of a different color, which is always part of...
Yes,
you know,
I think, I mean, someone like Cindy Crawford, Marilyn Monroe.
That is, with the mole on one side.
With the mole on one side.
But that aside, is a lot of the work of the makeup artist trying to get rid of the, hide the asymmetries, sort of make people more perfect?
In some instances. In celebrities or supermodels, no. We're actually trying to amplify their distinctiveness.
Do you think, Mario, that if we did, and maybe somebody has already done this, quantify the symmetries in 1,000 faces, that would correspond directly to attractiveness?
Yeah, I think our faces are not entirely symmetrical in any case. And if you did our faces to be very precisely symmetric, they look a little bit strange. I mean, let's face it. Human beings, we like to think of ourselves as being slightly more sophisticated than peahens. So, if the animals choose that because of the strength of the genes, I mean, we can still find, I don't know, Lyle Lovett attractive, even though his face is strongly asymmetrical.
Good example of the ultimately asymmetrical celebrity, I guess.
Hopefully... in spite of what has been ingrained in our brains, you know, over millennia, I mean, once somebody is already considered attractive or, you know, interesting in some ways, I mean, you would definitely not want to change that, to make him more symmetrical or her.
Mario Livio, Kelly Kwan, thank you both very much for joining me today in Studio 360.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Kelly Kwan is a makeup artist and founder of the online fashion magazine Zuzoom.com. Mario Livio is senior astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. His recent book is The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved. To find out more about both of them, visit our website at studio360.org. Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
You
You've been listening to a segment from PRI's Studio 360. If you'd like to hear the show in its entirety, visit studio360.org to find out when the program is broadcast on your local public radio station.